Hello and happy new year. Welcome to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast. And this is one that we recorded just before Christmas with Chris Eby from Northcross Developments. And it kind of goes back to when we originally started this thing and everything was about Toronto. Because a big thing is happening in Toronto. It's happening at the Downsview Airport, now known as YZB. And effectively, it's building an entire new urban hub on the space where there used to be an airport that used to manufacture aeroplanes. It used to be a very industrial bit of the city, but it's now going to become this new residential, commercial kind of space. It's going to take a really long time. It's going to be a multi-decade project. I actually got introduced to the folks at Northcross when I was maybe a little bit critical about the timelines that this is going to take. But honestly, I think it's amazing. This is the sort of thing that Toronto needs because it's what gives me hope that Toronto can be really, really awesome. So this is a conversation with Chris Eby all about how you build 10 new neighborhoods on an old airport. Enjoy. Chris, thank you so much for doing this conversation with me so close to Christmas. I appreciate you. Like, this is one of the few things standing between work and family time. But like, when I first did this tranche of Toronto-based, like, centric into conversations, I came across what's happening in Downsview, and like, it's probably one of the things that Toronto can be most proud of for its future as the city. So I really appreciate you taking the time to have a chat with me. Rather than me blessing your introduction, I'd love to just like get a little bit into who Chris Eby is and a bit on the sort of Northcross properties and Downsview development. We'll go from there.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here and do this and talk to you. So, I mean, my title is Executive Vice President of Corporate and Public Affairs for Northcross, which is, you know, sort of a fancy sounding thing. What it really means is that I'm responsible for all the public facing aspects of the project. So government relations, stakeholder management, all of our public engagement, public consultation that we do, brand, marketing, communications, all of our site activation. So anything that touches on the public is my responsibility. And I was actually employee number one at Northcross when it was formed in 2018 after the Public Sector Pension Investment Board bought the Downsview Airport lands from Bombardier. They did a couple of things that they don't typically do. They took this on alone. They would normally come in with partners. And the second thing is they created a wholly owned subsidiary to lead the redevelopment. And so I came out of the then mayor, John Tory's office to do this. And, you know, I was looking for something so I could continue helping build the city I love and I've grown up in and I'm raising kids in. And this to me seemed like the greatest opportunity to do that because it is the largest urban redevelopment or transformation in North America currently, and such an exciting project with so much, but like anything like this, wrought with challenges and opportunities, great opportunities, but not, you know, these are not easy things to do. So we've built a great team and a great company, and we've had some great wins in the early going.
So let's just go to the top. So many people who listen to this are in Toronto. Many people who listen to this are not. So for people who are not familiar with Downsview and Toronto and the project, tell us a little bit about that sort of where we are and where we're going to go.
So the Downsview Airport lands are what we're calling YZD now, which is the call sign for the airport, has been an airfield, a test strip, an Air Force base, manufacturing, an aerospace manufacturing hub for more than 100 years. It is, if you put a pin in the middle of the greater Toronto region, it would be in Downsview. So it's at the crossroads of probably some of the busiest highways in the city, the 401, which is the busiest highway in North America, and you know, very close to the 400, which is the main north-south route that takes you you know, north of the city. It's also the high point of land in Toronto, which is why it was chosen as an airstrip. And it's the crest of sort of it's the high point of land between the two main rivers in the city, the Humber and the Don. So it was most recently owned by Bombardier, which makes almost exclusively now private business jets. Mm-hmm. And it's been a center for aerospace innovation, as I say, for most of its history. The Mosquito fighter bomber that was, you know, a pivotal aircraft in the Second World War was manufactured there. So a really amazing history of aerospace innovation and just innovation generally. And then more recently, it's hosted some of the biggest gatherings in the city's history. So two papal visits at about 600,000 people each, and one of the most famous and the biggest rock concert ever in the city's history, the Molson Canadian Toronto Rocks, better known as Sarstock. And I was there as a late teen or early 20s kid, walked up the Allen Road, which was a pretty cool experience. Never been more dehydrated in my entire life. I may or may not have thrown a water bottle at Justin Timberlake. And I remember AC/DC was like the standout of the show. They literally brought the house down. So very cool for me to sort of, you know, come back to it 20 years later and to be working on this project, which, you know, we hope does, you know, a bunch of things, including to redefine how we're going to live in cities for the next number of decades.
I think it's like a really interesting one as well. Like when you talk about it being at the center, and I think a lot of the time people talk about when they think of city centers and downtowns, they're thinking of like what in Toronto might be like Yonge or Bay or King or Queen. Downtown is actually like Toronto is so sprawled. The idea of like having this thing that's at the center of the GTA is like almost like, I think there's this interesting trend of like re-anchoring cities around multiple centers versus one center. So that's probably like a really exciting piece of this project for what does it mean to go and take this piece of land and turn it into something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't happen overnight. I think we first started chatting because I was like, why does this take so long? But it's actually a lot of work to do over a 2 or 3 decade kind of time span, right?
It's a huge amount of work. And we've really only just begun. This is now my sixth year. This December is my sixth year at Northcrest. And, you know, we've moved at incredible speed. And that's because there's so much alignment with all three levels of government, the desire to get housing built, housing that's got, you know, a transit story associated with it, to begin building the foundations for new job creation. And these are, you know, the jobs of the future in creative industries and advanced manufacturing and life sciences, those sorts of sectors. And to just, I think, build better communities, more complete communities, great public spaces, parks, green space, buildings that are designed better. As I say, we've really just begun. The focus for us in the very early going was, you know, finding out from the local community and really from people and stakeholders from across the city and the region what their priorities are. Talking to Indigenous peoples, talking to, as I say, the local population, local businesses. And, you know, it always helps to follow a bad act. And we came right after Sidewalk and Sidewalk Labs sort of imploded. And I was at the city and I was in the mayor's office for that. And so you learn a lot of lessons and you learn a lot from what they got wrong. They didn't get everything wrong, but they definitely got that part wrong. And what I'm talking about specifically is, you know, meaningful engagement with the community and with the people who are there now. And so we made a concerted effort to do that. One of the first calls for me was to Chief Stacey Laforme of the Mississaugas of the Credit, who are the treaty holders for Toronto and for Downsview. And I still remember, you know, his advice or his thoughts to me was think big. And so we've tried to honor that. And we've tried to honor really what so many people told us. And there were so many common threads. But, you know, if there's one overarching, you know, theme, I would say it's people, especially people in the suburbs, want walkable, convenient communities and neighborhoods where they don't have to rely on the car, where there are good public spaces, where there's attention to aesthetics and to detail, and where they have all the amenities that are available downtown. And that means everything from like good restaurants, cafes, stores to, you know, a variety of different employment opportunities. So we've been working closely with the city, with local residents, businesses, stakeholders, as I said, and this past May, we were able to get a new secondary plan approved, and it was approved unanimously at council. And, you know, secondary plans can take 10 years. This one took 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And so now we're in the process of getting, you know, our district plans, which are the plans at the neighborhood level, approved. And the next big challenge is getting the infrastructure that's required to bring this site to life. And I'm talking about everything from sewers to water pipes to roads to parks, getting all of that financed and built. And so we're digging in on that now.
In terms of like what this place is going to turn into, I think so often it's not just a Toronto thing, it's lots of cities have had a big piece of land come available, and then it almost becomes like this is all housing or this is all offices, and it doesn't necessarily get the mix right. What will Downsview look like in 20, 30 years in terms of a new neighborhood?
So, you know, there's 7 new neighborhoods that we're building, and then our neighbors, Canada Lands Company, who are involved in the secondary plan process, are building an additional 3. So 10 new neighborhoods. And I think, you know, one of the key focus areas for us, and something we heard loud and clear in all of our public engagement, and something, again, I think we instinctively know to be true, and our designers and our master planners really pushed us on this too, was access to nature. So we've got Downsview Park just on the west side of our site, you know, about 200 acres of green space, a relatively new park in the city, one that's still building an audience. And so we thought, you know, let's really find a way to leverage that and pull it into the east side of the site. And there is a west-east divide, and that's the Barrie GO rail line, so a regional rail line that effectively bisects the site. So, you know, the task for us, number one, is to pull Downsview Park from west to east, and to do that through a number of overpasses and underpasses, some of which are 3 of, they're going to be 5 in total, 3 will be pedestrian and cycle only. And then to really, you know, to double down in effect on access to nature, green space. And so we will be building, in addition to what's already there, Downsview Park, 100 acres of new park space. And so the idea is that wherever you work or live in new Downsview or YZD, you will not be more than a 5-minute walk from a park or an open space. And we're not just going to have all passive parks either. We're starting to experiment now with different forms of programming, and that's everything from recreation, you know, so we'll have tennis courts or basketball courts or cricket pitches, to arts and culture, to performance spaces, live music and public art. So creating a really vibrant series of neighborhoods that will all have access to green space and nature. And we know how important this is for wellness, you know, for reducing stress, for just having people live healthier, happier lives. So the green space and that access to nature is, you know, one key feature. The other is, and this is also sort of on a related point on public space, is we're going to be preserving the runway, which is really the dominant and defining physical feature of the site. You know, it's a 2.1 kilometer long piece of concrete, 60 meters wide. So we'll be reimagining that into a pedestrianized boulevard. And it won't run, you know, exactly as the runway runs today, but what it'll do is form the connective tissue for all the new neighborhoods we're building. And it'll have different sort of moments as you traverse the length of the space. You know, some will be more park focused, others will be more, you know, more programmed. And it's really our version of the High Line, but more ambitious, longer, you know, and more diverse in the offering.
How do you think this will change the city? Because it's in the center, but it's actually not, it's quite far towards the end of one of the subway lines. It's a bit like the GO train is going through a massive improvement. So it's not going to be terribly far to get to, but distance-wise, it's not necessarily classically what you think of Toronto. I think you have the potential to make a completely radically transformative center of Toronto. How do you see that evolving?
Yeah, I mean, we put it pretty simply. We say that this is going to shift the center of gravity north. Downtown is great. I've spent most of my life close to downtown. I live in Midtown, actually, but, you know, I work downtown. You know, when I was younger, I spent a lot more time in, you know, bars and restaurants downtown. I love downtown. It's great, but feels we need a variety of pubs, as you said earlier, and we've got one at Yonge and Eglinton, which, you know, I'll let others sort of, you know, weigh in on whether that's been a success or not.
We'll wait until the LRT opens, then we can make mine.
Right. And that's definitely going to help a lot. But, you know, we need to build multiple hubs. And North York Center, again, you know, 30, 40 years old. I think they, you know, got some things right and other things, you know, could use some improvement. So this is an opportunity to create a new hub. mm-hmm. to really have it built around transit. We've got what every large development site wants, which is transit in operation now. We've got 3 subway stations and a GO station. And frankly, a huge 520-acre swath of mostly vacant land in the biggest city in the country. So a huge opportunity to create that new hub. And as I say, to center it not only around housing and employment, but great public spaces. And the more, we're going, all over the world. Our team is looking at what makes public spaces great and how they work in different cities. And that is a huge focus for us because we think that's just, it's the key ingredient to making this a great place. And again, very cool to be able to work on, a project where we are creating a brand new place in an established city.
I think there's things that like Toronto has by geography. The ravines are a great example. Not enough people know about that. Maybe people who live here don't appreciate it quite enough. But there's those things that are actually amazing spaces that are uniquely Toronto. The waterfront, it's got its good and bad bits. Some bits are okay. Some bits are amazing. It could be a lot better. A lot of people talk about that. And there's other public spaces that just feel a little bit like watered down. How do you combat that sort of slight, and I can say this as a Brit who's become Canadian, but like slight Canadian tendency sometimes to go, let's just pull that back a bit. We don't want it to be quite so provocative. How are you managing that sort of looking at the world for what's best, making it uniquely Toronto? How do you bridge that sort of gap so that what you create is truly special?
I've got a theory on this because it's baffled me as well. I mean, why we don't have better public spaces in Toronto. I mean, and you're right, we do have some, but they tend to be very passive. We don't spend a lot of time or money on these things as a city. And, my theory anyway is that a lot of older Canadians, and they don't, not necessarily like high income people who are in the, working class, middle class, they have cottages, they have places, quote unquote, up north or in the country. And so, when they have free time, on the weekend or, in the summer, they get out of the city and they head to these places. And so there's never really been the push on governments to build great public spaces in the city because people have their own sort of private oases dotted in cottage country or, through the sort of rural parts of Ontario, which are beautiful, right? And we have this incredible land and geography. But I think that's changing is the point. I think that, more modern Toronto people, we're a 50-50 city, meaning, half the population was born outside the city. I don't think that that's as common anymore. It's too expensive. Yeah, some of these places are being passed down generation from generation. But I think most of the people who have immigrated to the city in the last number of decades don't have that. So there is now a real desire in the growing population or the new population in the city to have great public spaces here that people can enjoy with their families. And so we're really trying to respond to that. And I think your question was, how do we do it? I think we learn from the rest of the world, what's working there. You don't have to go too far. I mean, even Montreal, I would say, does a lot of these things better. I was just in New York and Detroit. I was in Europe last time this year, looking at London and Berlin and Copenhagen and Paris. And so we're trying to take sort of the best of the world and overlay that on, things we know Canadians value and think are important and stuff that we know that, the community has told us directly what they want. In a lot of cases, that is going to be the success or the failure of this is if we get that right. I mean, we'll do a great job building housing and building great neighborhoods and hopefully attracting some great new industries. But for me anyway, if we don't get that public space right and we don't get the runway right or what the runway will become right, then we won't have done our jobs.
It's really interesting. I like your cottage theory. So like when I moved to Toronto 7 or 8 years ago, going to cottage country on a Friday night was 2 and a bit hours. Now it can be 4 hours.
Yeah.
So like getting to your haven is harder.
Well, yeah.
And then I've done a lot of work in the Maritimes over the years, and I've been to more than my fair share of kitchen parties. But it's interesting in some of those bits of Canada, somebody's kitchen, and it might be quite a rustic kitchen in New Brunswick or it might be a very expensive custom kitchen that a tech person has created in their home in Cologne. But those kitchens become more like shared spaces than, or more like public spaces than lots of our public spaces become. And I feel like we're almost like applying like this Canadian-ness that we've had in our homes back to the public realm, where we've been almost too puritanical around like the sign in Toronto that says no hitting home runs at a baseball field, or the sign in Halifax that says no jogging through a park. Like, we're now kind of being a bit more grown up about this and applying like our character and our culture, but to the public space, it's barely than never, right? So it's interesting. Where have you, like, where's the place that you probably looked at that surprised you the most and gone, hang on, we need a little bit of that? Why is that, Dave?
Well, I mean, it was very instructive to see, and this is just because it's, you know, the most recent thing, but, you know, New York has such a variety of cool public spaces, you know, some of which are privately owned and operated, some of which are operated by the city. I mean, I think what they did with the High Line, just because it's close to what we're doing, which is to transform a formerly, you know, industrial, that's a transportation corridor, but, you know, it reminds me a lot of what we're trying to do. You know, in Brooklyn, I saw this Domino Park. As I understand it, is owned, or it's private land, and it was, you know, it was donated for this purpose, and it's managed by a conservancy or a trust or something like that. But it has that very similar sort of, you know, these different urban rooms where there's sort of, you know, there's gathering spaces, there's recreation spaces, there's performance spaces, there's traditional or more traditional parks. And it's, you know, one not a lot of people are talking about. And we literally were like, we're driving to the airport and said, let's just pop by and see this thing. And it kind of blew our minds. But, you know, there's so much that's out there. And I really care about the city. I grew up here, as I said. I love this place. I've done, you know, even a couple of years doing public service, and I think it's really time. You know, like we need this badly as a city, and I just wish we could do it faster, frankly, because I think we need it now. And I think we just need to sort of rethink how we look at this, how we prioritize it. You know, our investments in it. You know, we had a great proposal, which was called Rail Deck Park, when I was in the mayor's office. And it just runs into the typical things you run into. And in this case, it was an unfavorable ruling by the land tribunal. You know, we were also going to have a problem raising money for it or funding it, but I think we would have gotten there. And so I think it's a mix of, you know, public investment and philanthropy. You know, in our case, this is a project that really only a pension fund that has a long-term investment horizon can do. You know, I think, again, just to return, like prioritizing that, putting it on the same, you know, level as the buildings, you know, as the infrastructure, you know, I think has to be done, because we can't just, you know, we have to be able to chew gum and walk at the same time. We can't just be about building buildings or building transit. It's ultimately building a city that works for people and that people want to be in. And they do want to be here, because there's so many great things about Toronto, with the relative safety, you know, the jobs that are available, you know, the restaurants, you know, it all. But I think this is the one thing that to me is clearly lacking, and we're going to have a big impact on that.
I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with Toronto.
Yeah, I think we all do. But I think that's true of anyone living in a city, right? Because there's more people, there's more cars, it's harder to get around, the transit systems, I don't care where you are, they have their issues.
Mm-hmm.
But it's particularly pronounced in Toronto right now, because there's so much building going on, because we took, you know, 30 or 40 years off building, and now we're trying to play catch up.
What's it like when it comes to, because I feel like it's very fashionable, and like one of the people, Hayden Clark, and I interviewed a couple of weeks ago for this, he wrote a piece, and it's sort of, and I've written pieces myself where we've got obsessed with process. You talked about secondary plans, getting them approved, take 10 years. You've managed to do it 2.5. What is it like going through that? Yes, there are a certain amount of consultations and approvals and processes for good reason. How do you make sure that doesn't water down your project, doesn't delay the project, doesn't mean you have to like cut pieces because they're no longer fitting the funding model? And how does that work in terms of you've got to manage the city, you got to manage the province, I'm sure the feds have a view as well. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that sounds like the most painful piece of the job.
And as I say, I mean, we've been very lucky that there is so much alignment between the three levels of government. And, you know, and frankly, the civil service at City Hall gets it, right? They get the massive opportunity here, and they're equally as excited about this. But it does take constant, you know, care and feeding and watering to make sure that both the elected officials are, you know, up to speed on it, that they remain supportive, that regardless of what governments come in, that they're going to help this move forward. You know, and there's just this natural kind of inertia, especially at the bureaucratic level. Like we've done an amazing job getting the secondary plan done in record time, but we've got to keep that momentum going, because that is a big risk. You're totally right. And it is painful at times, but you know, there's just that natural inclination to say, okay, you know, we've got a big win, and now we're just going to rest on our laurels a little bit. So, you know, it's something that I focus on, you know, pretty much daily. And it's a big job, because the city does have so much, you know, influence over this, but the timing of it, what it's going to cost, how it's going to look. I mean, there's urban design guidelines, there's all kinds of requirements, everything from the width of the roads. We want them to be very narrow. We want this to feel like, you know, sort of a European city. The city likes wider rights of ways. So there's, you know, we're having those discussions constantly. I'm happy to say that for the most part, we get to agreement. But it's nonstop. And there are days when, you know, I talk to our planners and designers, and they're dispirited, and they've, you know, just had like a 6-hour meeting with the city, and they just, you know, are pulling their hair out. But then there's also times where, you know, we're able to just plow through these things really quickly. But, you know, I'll say at the same time is like, you can't, there are certain steps you can't skip. Like, you have to make sure that the public feels like they're part of this, and that their input is being taken seriously, and that they see it reflected in the plans that you're bringing forward. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. We're getting a little more resistance from, you know, at least one neighborhood as we're getting into a more detailed level of sort of design. The standard things, you know, concerns about more traffic, concerns about building heights, concerns about new people coming in. But, you know, I think that the thing I've really been impressed about with the people living in Downsview, the people that I talk to, you know, almost every day, is that they are prepared to make the trade-off for, you know, more people, more cars, more traffic, more noise, because they really want, as I said, access to great parks and schools and community centers and restaurants and shops. They just don't, you know, it's part of what they like about living in the suburbs. It is quieter, but there's definitely a pronounced lack of amenities. It's an amenity-starved part of the city, and they don't want to drive downtown. They'd like to have it, you know, steps from their front doors.
With an interesting, you touched on traffic a little bit before, but I think there's like the 401 is crazy, but it's this idea that we almost have this bonkers amount of traffic on the 401, because to go anywhere, like, you have to go to the DVP, to the 427, to then go downtown and get on the Garden, whatever it might be. And actually, if we had a better city center, that traffic on the 401 might not be so bad, because people from the suburbs can go over to that neighborhood, and maybe they'll ride a bicycle, but maybe they'll drive a car. Maybe there'll be some other piece of transit that comes across the top of the city at some point in the future. But actually, if we can create better hubs, maybe that relieves traffic rather than adding to traffic.
Definitely. And I mean, walkability is such a huge thing, you know, for us is just creating neighborhoods where you don't need a car. And again, we're on the car type thing. It's just, it's giving people options. And right now it feels like living in the city, one of the only good options to get around, and it's not a good option because traffic is terrible, as you mentioned, is the car. And I mean, partly that's because we're a big spread out city. You know, we're not Amsterdam. We're tightly packed into this, you know, very kind of small area. It's a very spread out city. You know, I'd say our transit system doesn't really get you to a lot of places. It's great if you live along Yonge Street or, you know, along Bloor. That's changing, hopefully soon. But, you know, it's an okay transit system. It's not great. You know, I think, you know, our bike lane network, you know, we could spend a whole, you know, podcast on that. But the fact is we're a cold weather climate, or not even cold so much as a bad weather climate, for at least 6 months of the year, you know, where it's either too hot raining, cold, and, you know, frankly, if you've got kids, it's not always an option to take a bike.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to rely on the car to an extent, but if you have the opportunity to build brand new neighborhoods, like the opportunity we have, you can design it in a way where you don't need to rely on the car as much. And so that's another huge focus for us.
I think it's like, I haven't put this episode out, it'll go out just before this one, but like talking around cycling in the Netherlands, like it rains a lot there. It's gray, it can be windy, it can be chilly. Like it's not as cold as Canada, it's not as snowy as Canada, but it's not necessarily like the picturesque idyll of riding a bicycle, but people do it because they do enough to make it go, well, I can ride my bike a couple of kilometers to that station and then get the train to go 50 kilometers away. And I think like that's the thing that we sort of sometimes miss when you talk about making it walkable or these underpasses being, or three of these underpasses being like cycling and pedestrian. That to me gives me so much hope that, hang on, we can get this previously suburban space to be an urban center where we can ride a bike, we can drive a car, we can get on a train, we can get on the subway. And it just works. That to me is Toronto. Like we might be late to the party, but we're getting it.
We're getting there for sure. You know, on all these counts, on public spaces, better transit or better sort of mobility options, you know, I think 25 is going to be a big year for the city. And you know, as a, I describe myself as a frequently disappointed optimist, but I am an optimist. And I think 25 is going to be a big year. You know, the Don River Park, which is just an incredible project, global and, you know, ambition and scale, is going to open, and that will create, you know, an amazing series of public spaces on our waterfront, which is, as you noted earlier, is you know, a missed opportunity, or feels like it's a missed opportunity. Second, the crosstown is going to open hopefully early in the year. That'll be a game changer. It'll take a lot of cars off the road. It'll clear up a lot of congestion. It'll take a while to build, you know, a ridership, but we have to have that. It's just such a key piece of the system. And then, you know, I'm biased, but, you know, we're going to do our first big move, which is to have a 50,000 person, you know, outdoor stadium in downtown, the largest concert venue in the country. And it'll really reintroduce this site, which has been closed off for so many years, to the public. And hopefully it inspires people to, you know, to come in. And, you know, this might sound cliche, but it's true. Like to dream with us about what this place can be and get them excited about the future and get them involved. And there's other things that are happening too, but those are sort of the big three in my mind. You know, I really do think that the Toronto's best days are ahead, but we've got to make sure that, you know, we get these things right. And so my focus, you know, my job day to day is making sure we get the Downsview piece right. And, you know, I'll keep doing that until they tell me to stop.
Is that the stadium like a temporary thing while you get the other ducks in a row of like residential, commercial, or is that going to always be there?
I mean, I think we'll always have music in some form on the site in different venues, in different places, maybe even happening at the same time. But this is, you know, such a big chunk of land, in like 370 acres. We can only develop, you know, one neighborhood at a time or you know, in a staggered way, as we're finishing one, we're starting another, you know, because the big issue really is the servicing. It's just there are no water pipes or sewers or road. We got to build all of that. So this is a parcel that's not going to be needed for development for at least a decade, if not more. And so, you know, it's a shorter term lease than that, but we want to just test this out and see. I mean, there's music happening at the site now, the broader site. You know, people may have been to Veld in Downsview Park. There's a number of other concerts and festivals that happen there. And there's that, you know, historic tie in the recent history to music. So we thought it made sense to bring this back. And, you know, it's amazing how music unites people. You know, when people heard that like Oasis is coming, Coldplay is coming, you know, I heard from people that I haven't heard from in like 30 years. And I mean, there's definitely, you know, a few people with concerns in the community, and that's understandable. But most of the people are really excited for this. I think we need it. I mean, we heard loud and clear from people that they, you know, in addition to not having access to public spaces and amenities and community infrastructure, is especially in the suburbs, they feel like there's a dearth of arts and culture, and they want opportunities to enjoy concerts and music and art and not have to go downtown for it.
What's the biggest risk? You talked about you get pushback of adding to traffic congestion to people who've lived in the area for a while, but like, what's the biggest resistance that you kind of face in terms of pushing a big project like this through?
Well, the recent experience has been the new road network, because, you know, you have to understand that the existing neighborhoods, you know, that have been there for 50 or years or more, you know, they basically enjoyed, they were a giant cul-de-sac, or the ones, the neighborhoods to the south, that's sort of the main, you know, established residential neighborhood, single family homes. Because you had an airport, a working airport there that was fenced off, and you had the rail line, this one neighborhood, Ancaster, you know, effectively it was a giant cul-de-sac. So they had very little traffic in their neighborhood, and they loved that. And I don't blame them. But, you know, now that we're opening the site up and we're sort of stitching it back into the broader city, there is the opportunity to connect it to the rest of the Downsview area and North York. And, you know, we definitely heard that people want that. Because right now, I mean, if you're, you know, Dufferin, which is one of the oldest, longest streets in the city, it stops right at the south end of our site. And then it starts up again north of Shepherd. So we're going to be connecting that through the site and, you know, creating another major, at least one more north-south road, and then a couple east-west. So people don't have to like circumnavigate this massive site. If you've ever been up there, I mean, driving around it, yeah, you can't go from A to B right now. You have to sort of do this long, circuitous route. So, you know, I think people get the benefits of that, but then they're also worried about more cars coming into their neighborhood, especially since it's had this kind of unique, you know, structure or whatever, or way of being, because it was next to, you know, a closed off site and a rail line.
To me, Downsview, I still associate it with, that's where you go to buy a car. Because I bought a car in Downsview, I nearly bought another car in Downsview. I've test driven a couple of cars, like, because there's a lot of car dealerships in the area. So in my head, that's what Downsview is. So like, the idea of just turning that into something huge it's kind of still shocking to me. But yeah, like how you do that with the road network, I can appreciate that. Having driven around a test vehicle around there, I know it's not an easy job. There's something around like the transportation. So normally when you get these projects, you'll typically find they're connected to a giant new transportation line that's been created. I appreciate you've got the GO line that's been upgraded. There's more upgrades going to the subway, but like, you're not building any transit on top of what's already there, are you?
Well, I think, you know, longer term, we are looking at getting more transit to the site. You know, the city and the province are looking at extending the Shepherd subway line. So right now it stops at Yonge. We think there's a really strong case to extending it to Shepherd West Station, which is right on the east in a part of our site, and then through, and you know, maybe eventually extending it all the way to the airport. And, you know, I think we've got to stop being so unambitious about transit. You know, in Toronto, again, you look at the map in London or New York or Tokyo. I mean, ours just pales in comparison. So. You know, and I think the premier, Doug Ford, gets that. You know, he gets that you have to build subways, and it's painful for a time, you know, with what's going on with the Ontario line, but it has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So I can definitely see, or we will be pushing for the extension of that Shepherd line, you know, as the east-west coming, east-west subway connection coming through the site. I can see another GO station at the south end of our site. We've got the existing ones at the north end. And, you know, that has the potential to add even more density in the future. I don't know that anyone, you know, while they, like I said, they have concerns about building heights and people, but, you know, don't think that they're against density per se. And, you know, from our perspective, we need more of it.
Mm-hmm.
It needs more housing, more, you know, you can do more with more people. But the transit is a key, if not the key to doing that.
If I was you guys, and I'll pitch you on my grand transit plan to Canada, but I know if and when they build high frequency or high speed rail between Toronto and Montreal,
yes,
it will be eye-wateringly expensive and insanely complicated to get those high speed trains downtown to Toronto Union. And I almost wouldn't bother even trying. I would bring the station to you guys.
I have not sold on high speed rail. I think it works again in smaller geographies, but there's just so many complications with it in the Canadian context. And I think our money's better spent, you know, on subways and regional rail and some other things.
will politely disagree there, but if they build it, I want them to bring it to you guys.
You're from the UK, there's a rail culture there.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, Via is just such a miserable experience. It just seems like it's so expensive and such a massive undertaking to build that infrastructure. And then, you know, if you have the choice, and I'm in Montreal frequently because that's where the pension fund that owns us is headquartered, you know, you can do an hour flight from the Island Airport, or you can do a 3-hour train ride, which is what I understand the time would be if it was high speed. And yeah, there's the getting to the airport, all those sorts of things, but it's kind of, at the very best, it's a wash. And just given the customer service that some of us are used to on Via, or I'd say that my generation is used to, just it'd be like, it's a no-brainer. You take the flight every time.
As someone who's spent a lot of time on Via Rail lately between Toronto, Montreal, and Ottawa, it's a lot cheaper than flying because flight prices are insane. If I'm not expensing a flight to a client, I just can't justify dropping $1,000 on the fare. But Via makes it so hard for me to be an advocate for the train. So I'm hoping that whatever they build, and if and when they build it, isn't provided by Via. And I think I look at countries like Spain that doesn't have a railway culture or didn't have one, and they've done an amazing job building high-speed trains.
Yeah.
But also what the way they've done it has been like, let's not get like held up on the complicated bit. Let's see what we can do and use that to build the case. I think Toronto and Montreal should be much better connected, but this is my point around like different city centers and hubs. Like, you guys are a hub. What's happening at Pearson Airport's a hub. And I hope that makes Toronto this sort of city that reinvents what a city means. It's not just having a downtown and then rings around it. It's actually like, it's more of a nodes and a web, if you will.
Yeah. And we will, you know, if rail does gain some momentum, we probably do need a second rail hub outside of downtown. I mean, London has them, Paris has them, Tokyo, I'm sure, has them.
Shanghai's a great example of it. They just built stations at the edge and then been worried about doing that so you can get from Shanghai to Beijing. And then they're like, right, how do we bring it close to the center? It changes the way you think about the city and it changes the way people live. And I think that's really exciting. On that note, when it comes to technology, you're obviously having to think about how will the world look in 10 years, 25 years, 50 years, maybe even further than that. How are you thinking about what that means? And that might mean autonomous vehicles or AI or even just the changing social nature of how people will live. Like, how do you do that?
Well, that's very difficult just because technology is changing so fast. And, you know, I know this word is sort of, it feels like it's gone out of common usage, but future proof. I don't think there is a way to future proof this other than just trying to do it in a way that you know, affords the maximum flexibility. Because I think the worst, you know, one of the worst scenarios for us is we put all this infrastructure in the ground, whether it's, you know, power infrastructure or, you know, even roads or, you know, expensive big pieces of infrastructure. And in 5 years, they're obsolete. We're doing something completely different. And I think that's a real risk. Just again, given where we are with artificial intelligence and so many of these, you know, it's amazing the pace at which these things are changing. And so it is something we're thinking about, but I don't know that there's a perfect solution. I think you're going to try to use the latest and the greatest, and you're going to try to you know, build in the maximum flexibility, but there are going to be things that we, you know, put into the ground or build that are going to be obsolete by the time, you know, it's a 30, 40 year project. Stuff we do in the first district will look probably very different from the last district we built. You know, I think the sort of the overall kind of vision is the same, but the materials, the look of the buildings, how we integrate technology, it's all going to be different. So, you know, I think that in one sense, it'll probably be building and rebuilding constantly just to respond to how fast sort of technology is changing and just, you know, how people want to live and the climate and how that's changing how we, you know, experience the outdoors and how much time we're spending outdoors, all those sorts of things.
I like the way that you talk about that, because to me, like, the best way of thinking about the future is not trying to predict it and focus on a single right answer. So it's almost like the attitude you have seems to be more like, we won't always be right. We will evolve with the times. And that makes you almost more prepared for these four, five, 10 infinite different future scenarios so that, yeah, okay, there might be a building that looks sexy in 2030 and by 2040 it looks ugly and by 2050 it's back in fashion again. But that probably makes a more interesting and diverse city and environment than saying we have to stick to this master plan and one style of looking at things and we believe all people will live like this. Then at least you're going to be interesting and different and diverse, not really, really right or also cataclysmically wrong.
Right. We could avoid the latter. That would be good. I mean, there are some things we know we're not going to use. Like we will not be building any new fossil fuel infrastructure on the site. You know, this will be, you know, among the most advanced from a sustainability perspective, master plan communities in the country. You know, we're looking at batteries, we're looking at solar, we're looking at district energy, we're looking at a whole host of things, geothermal exchange. Again, that technology is changing really fast. But we do know some things, and one of them is that there will be no new fossil fuel infrastructure in use on the site. So the intention or the ambition is to be a fully electric master plan community of, you know, 120,000 people when it's all said and done. Hopefully it gets easier to do that. I mean, that's the bet that we're making, is that the technology, you know, renewables and sustainable energy and infrastructure, energy from waste, water, all of those sorts of things, that continues to improve and, put us more in a course of sustainable. The other thing we're doing, which I think is really cool and futuristic, is all the stormwater will be managed on site. So we're using all the parks, all the green spaces, the landscaped areas that we're building to basically soak up all the rainwater. So to make it sort of it's a sponge city concept. And that is groundbreaking and that is new. And we've got the city to agree to that. So, I think there's something, you know, we don't have a crystal ball, but we know that rain events are happening more frequently and they're more intense. And there's an existing problem with the sewers in North York. They back up all the time. So we can't add to that problem. And we think, you know, anytime you can sort of kill two birds with one stone, you know, have a lot of green space, have great, you know, landscaped areas and trees and parks, but it also serves that dual function of soaking up stormwater, then great.
There's lots of unsexy things in terms of doing what you're doing that I think we can get hung up on, like the concerts and the housing and the transportation, but then you don't necessarily see the, what does that mean for the power grid? What does that mean for the stormwater? So when you talk about that, like, that should be really, really important to everybody who lives in Toronto, wherever they live, because we've all just seen the floods from the summer.
Yeah.
And you guys are sitting at that high point. So if you're not doing what you're doing, the Don is going to get even worse. So like what you're doing is like, it's not just the benefit to the neighborhood, but it's the benefit to people who live downstream of you. So it's obvious when you say it like that, but I feel like it's one of those things that not enough people think about, and we've built too much of a city without thinking about that or passing on the burden to somebody else. So those are things that we should probably be celebrating a bit more.
Yeah, again, I mean, not to pick on Sidewalk excessively, but, you know, they weren't thinking that kind of stuff. Way to build better cities is through better planning and better infrastructure and better design. It's not technology in all cases, right? And you know, so much of what was wrong with Sidewalk was it was technology for technology's sake. And it didn't, there wasn't like a clear line to improving the issues that we all live with in cities. One of them being, as you know, when we have, you know, heavy rainfall events, everything's flooding.
Mm-hmm.
The roads, people's basements, you know, we have to deal with that. And it's not, you know, a delivery robot's not going to help with that. So we have to get those things right, as unsexy as they may be. And we have to get, as I say, like the road network right. We have to get the distribution of parks right. We have to, you know, those are the foundational elements of a great city. And we can't just leap toward, you know, hexagonal heated paving stones and, you know, drones flying around.
I'm connecting dots. There's other people that we've spoken to on this, especially in the last few recent few episodes. So like, Paul Cowfly's talked about cities that are about joy, and you've talked about public spaces. And if you build cities around that, it's about like where they hang out, where they can go have a drink, where they can play frisbee, cricket, whatever it might be. Go for a walk, sit in the sun, read a book. Like, all those ways that you enjoy public space. I feel like you've got a tip. You've talked a bit about like what the roads look like. Like Thomas Abelman talked about Oslo doing autonomous small buses and transit and things like that. So like you kind of have to get the infrastructure right for that to be able to let loose an autonomous bus. Like, I feel like, again, like laying the foundation there. We've had people talk about bikes. You're doing that. It's all these things and the list must be huge, but I feel like you're starting to bring all these things together. And I imagine that's all going to rub off on the other bits of Toronto that while they're having a silly argument about bike lanes, you're just getting on and doing stuff.
Yeah, in Toronto and hopefully cities around the world too. And you know, we've got so much talent here and so many smart people and creative people. And I don't know if it's a peculiar Canadian characteristic not to sort of thump our chests. But there's an opportunity to do it here, is to be at the forefront of the next wave of great cities. And, you know, we'll never be Paris and we'll never be London or Tokyo. But if we're known for, you know, an extremely livable place that, you know, as you said, has public space, great public spaces at its core, that has aesthetically pleasing building, you know, and that just functions. You know, where you can get around easily. You know, you can drop your kids off at the school, at their school or daycare, go to the grocery store, come. You don't have to commute long distances. You're not stuck in your car, you know, white knuckling it and cursing at traffic. Then, you know, I think we've won. And we can export that. I mean, there's a lot of other complexity, right? I mean, you know, getting the sustainability features right. You know, making sure we have things like charging infrastructure for cars. We have a road network that's, you know, easily navigable for EVs and that sort of thing, or autonomous vehicles rather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got to get that stuff right too. But there's sort of what I'll call like the base layer that is critical, and then everything else on top of that, you know, is gravy in a way, but contributes to that overall livability, which I think people crave more than anything else.
Yeah. And if you do that, then it actually changes a way that a lot of the ways that we do quite banal things. Like the way you shop for groceries in the Netherlands is often taking your bike or walking and grabbing something for a day or two. The way we shop for groceries in Canada is often going to Costco and buying stuff for 2 or 3 weeks and doing it in our car. And I think if you build the neighborhoods in that way, like, doesn't mean you can't go to the big box store on the edge of town in the car. But also, wouldn't it be nicer if we didn't have to do that as often? I think that's how you sort of change the world a little bit. And like that has a huge impact.
Yeah, you know, food is another big conversation we're having. Like it's access to affordable, healthy food is something we're trying to figure out. It's not, you know, there's talk of vertical farming and a bunch of different things. But like, you know, if we can grow some food on the site, we can have, you know, there's a concept of sort of social grocery stores and these sorts of things. But if we can change the way people shop, and I think there's massive impact on, you know, from everything from industrial farming to, you know, making that more local, the impact on the environment. So that's another piece we're looking at and we're trying to figure out. And it's changing rapidly. And so we're going to do some experimentation with some of the land we don't immediately need for development on that too, because it is such a critical piece.
I like to end these conversations on, if you had a magic wand for a wish or a command for something of what you're working on at the moment, what would you do with the magic wand? What would you wish for?
I would make sure that I'm alive to see it. I'm turning 50 this year, and I'd really like to be not only alive, but like healthy, you know, and able to walk around and vigorous. And I know that's sort of a very self-centered thing to say, but I really mean that. Like, I want to see what this thing looks like when it's fully built out. And it's not going to be exactly the vision that we've presented. It's going to evolve and change over time. I think the core fundamental pieces will be there. You know, like the runway, like the, you know, access to nature. You know, I want to see it and maybe even live there and have my, you know, kids live there as well. I think that there's just, you know, there's such excitement now, but I want to see it when it's open and people are living there and it's fully up and running.
Well, here's that. There's no greater incentive to get on and do things and make it happen. And also, you'll be there. You'll see it. And you'll be like, I did that. That's going to be an amazing thing. Chris, thanks so much. Like, I really appreciate you. Like, you're so candid, open, sharing with what's going on. So I'll put links to the project, and hopefully people can go get excited about it, because I think, like, well, I know I can be a bit of a moaner and a bit of a critic around Toronto, but like, there are things that Toronto is doing that gives me so much hope for the future. And you know, why is it these definitely at the top of that list?
No city is perfect, but you know, I feel like we, like I said, the best days are still to come, and we're a big part of that, hopefully.
It's that. What a lovely note to end on.
Okay.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast. We've got lots more coming up, so very excited to share more with you in the not too distant future. And if you liked it, rate it well, share it, tell your friends, and we'll see where this goes. Thanks very much.